So we did last time that we gathered for Foundations for Thoughtful Judaism. We looked at material related to the foundations for Jewish ethics. So one, according to David Hartman of Blessed Memory, of course, this is the Hartman curriculum. So of course, it's, made in the image of Rabbi David Hartman. And so he really talked about two pillars of Jewish ethical thought. The two foundations, the two pillars are creation ethics, which we talked about last time, and the one we're going to talk about this time, which is covenant ethics. This is a different, the second pillar, a different way of organizing our understanding of the underpinnings of our ethical obligations to one another. And hopefully you got your source sheet. Yes. There should be two things as part of your source material. One is the Hartman sources. And the second is me being OCD, and deciding that, we might want to look at least just at two verses, maybe three, depending on how much time we have, at how the rabbis expand past even right, drawing on the biblical understanding of the underpinnings of interpersonal ethics, and in this case, as regards covenant ethics. Okay. So we'll see how much time we have. We see how far we get. And then before the end of the class, I want to decide if we want to look at Yehuda Kurtzer for next time, or do we want to go on, and look at a, another unit of ethics? So I want to hear from those of you who read Kurtzer, or those of you who are maybe curious about it and want me to talk about it. It's too much to do the whole thing, but I feel like if people read it, we could kind of look at the four ethical commitments he has outlined there as we look at Israel at a time of war. Okay? So we'll decide that before the end of this session together. Okay. So someone tell me what was creation ethics about for the folks who weren't here last week. But tell me a little bit about what are the ideas that undergird creation ethics?
Human dignity.
Human dignity. And where do we see that, Mary?
And how the first humans are described.
So they are described as being in the image of the divine. And since all human beings descend from mythically descend from Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, then it must mean that if they have this dignity by being created in the image of the divine, so do all human beings. Okay? That is a fundamental tenet right there in the first chapter of Genesis, a fundamental tenet of Jewish philosophy. All human beings have some kind of inherent dignity, worth, are worthy of respect, because they are created in the image of the divine. We won't spend time now. We did last week on what that means. But what it means is that there's something about the human being that created in the image of the divine, whatever that may mean, that means they are worthy of, not minimally not being murdered, right? Destroying that image, unless we're talking about capital punishment, which we talked about. And, or, but it goes beyond just not killing somebody, right? That there are other obligations we have to all human beings in order to protect, that sense of dignity that every human being's, has inherently just by virtue of being B'Tselem Elohim. Okay. So we looked at those texts. Any other texts come to mind? We did the Genesis texts. Anything else come to mind?
Well, about Genesis, that the creation of humans was good.
That the
Actually, very
creation
good.
of human was very good. That there was one human being created originally, right? The earthling. Male and female, God created them both, right? The earthling is created first. Male and female are created first. That means no one could ever say to someone else, my ancestry is better than yours. Because ultimately, if you push that far enough, you push that to the wall, you've got a problem. Because since we all descend from.
Or my gender.
and if you we want to take it literally, then of course my gender as well, that both genders are there at the very beginning of Genesis 1. Susan?
Well, also we are assigned or obligated stewardship of all the animals of the earth, of the sea, of all the plants. We are to be stewards of the world.
And how does that speak to universal human ethics vis-a-vis our responsibilities to one another?
Well, because if we go around like destroying someone's fields, then we're harming the earth, but we're also harming the people who could be fed from those fields.
Okay, so you want to extend past what we do to each other to talk about the other creatures. Fine.
Although we didn't go into
although we were.
No, that's okay. All right. I was going to take you somewhere else.
Okay. So that's where we're at in terms of reviewing what we did last time. Creation, ethics. Yes? All of these sources are available online. So you can, if you didn't make it last time, you can print them out and look at them.
Actually, we didn't go into it. I'm talking about free will, that we have a decision as to what we can do or not do.
Which is, we wouldn't be talking about ethics if we didn't have free will.
Which underpins ethics.
All right. So that the reason we can talk about ethics is because we do have choice, and with choice comes responsibility to make choices because we have control over them. And so, of course, we have a system that tells us what should those choices be if we're going to want to do what's right. Because ethics is all about trying to figure out, and sometimes the big work is figuring out what is the right thing to do, right? The next level is, okay, how do I get myself to do that? Right? Instead of often what I want to do, right? All right, so we're going to look now at the second kind of ethics present in Jewish thought according to, it's not just David Hartman, but this is his language for it and the texts that they bring forward. And that is covenant ethics. So there is an ethics of universality. We in the West who are inheritors in our modern industrialized country, we are inheritors of the Greek philosophers, who really, a lot of Greek philosophy around what is ethical is, by definition, it is ethical if it is universal. Right? Like, that's how you know something is truly ethical, is that it is absolutely true in all cases, all the time. Right? And this is the highest pinnacle of ethical thinking and of moral development, is that you get to a place where you understand what is true and how to live into what is ethically, morally right and true at the highest possible level, which is it's true always. Okay, so we have a lot of that in us, even if we don't know it, right? So we always just want to name some of these things, that we are inheritors of that as much as we are, if not more so, than inheritors of the Jewish tradition. Like, a lot of us are more fluent in Western thought and philosophy than we are in Jewish thought and philosophy. All right, so we're going to look at five texts during our time together. And the first one is pretty it's not a Jewish text. It is a text that is in response to the way that ethics have been understood traditionally, mostly, of course, in patriarchal civilizations, because that's what we live in, most of us. And America evolved in that, and that is what we said, what we kind of marinate in as Americans, but also as just Western folks in general. So if you look at source number one, we're going to look at Carol Gilligan. I read Carol Gilligan when I was in college, which tells you how old I'm going to be tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Very old. We studied her at Northwestern when I was there in sociology, because she was making an argument that challenged how everyone understood moral development based on theories that had been developed about people studying boys. Moral development, and that kind of being for a long time, and Kanoff can say a lot more to that than I can, but for a long time, like, that was kind of the main paradigm, was studying boys' moral development, and then, of course, men, and like, that is the, and the default. Pinnacle of, huh?
Default.
Right, that's the default way of looking at moral development, and girls fell short of that often because, of course, it's a male system. So, but we're going to look at Carol Gilligan because Gilligan, and I didn't bring this, Hartman brought this, which I find very interesting as we're talking about Jewish ethics, right? And covenant ethics, they are the ones who brought forth Carol Gilligan revisiting in a different voice. This is from a keynote address on April 1st, 2014. And so this is, you know, she was coming from a place of feminist ethics. And feminist ethics argues that relationships are morally relevant, that you can't talk about what's moral and what's ethical outside of relationships. So you'd ask a boy, is it right to steal the medicine, you know, to treat, you know, someone who's dying? Can you steal in order to get the money for that medicine? And the girls would say, well, who's dying? Do you know the store owner you're stealing from? Right. And of course, the questioners were like, that's not important. Should you steal it or not? Right. And the girls were saying, but I have to know who's dying, and like, who do I know better, the person dying or the person who owns the store, whatever. So that is the context in which Carol Gilligan is writing. And so asking different kinds of ethical questions, seeing humans as operating in more of a network of mutuality, this is how she understood another way of understanding moral and ethical development. So rather than it being a zero-sum game, right, that idea that there's lots of impacts that happen for every choice we make, and it's important to know what exactly are the different ripples of what I'm going to do and who it's going to affect. And so Jewish ethics shares, the Hartman folks are saying, Jewish ethics shares that understanding that moral and ethical decisions and what's right and what's wrong in any given situation is based on interrelatedness. It's not just what's true always in some kind of abstract kind of way of thinking about things. All right. So let's look at source number one on your source sheet. Somebody want to read?
Our lives are embedded in a network of relationships. As humans, we're interdependent. It's the understanding of the human condition that Martin Luther King articulates in his letter from the Birmingham jail. Quote, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. What affects one directly affects all indirectly. Close quote. From this vantage point, the parameters of judgment and action shift. I have written at length about this paradigm shift, explaining that it does not mean choosing relationships over self or caring over justice. Instead, it signifies a change in the question. Rather than seeking to establish whose rights take precedence in a contest of rights, the question becomes how to act in a network of mutuality where one directly affects all indirectly, like walking on a trampoline.
All right, so if we were to talk about the discussion these days in our so advanced 2024 first world industrialized Western country, how are we doing talking about decisions about what's right and what people right deserve and what they are entitled to and what we should be doing for folks? How are we doing about seeing it as walking on a trampoline, that if I do this, it affects something over here, or how much we're seeing it as a zero sum game?
Pretty much the latter.
Say more.
Well, if you want to go back to reproductive rights, so that if you come in with an absolutist concept of what is a life or when a life begins, there's no nuance in there. There's no allowance for understanding the circumstances. So, and I think if you're going back to like idea of the absolutes, people who think that they know what is right because God told them or whatever, is self-evident. And there's no room for nuance, no room for looking at how what you're going to do is going to affect people beyond that question.
Or that only...
And I think it's a result of fundamentalism.
I was going to say, and or that only one of the individuals involved in that ethical decision matters, right? So that
the embryo matters.
The embryo so if the woman might suffer so much because of whatever circumstances got her to being pregnant, the fetus is life. All life, all fetal life must be preserved no matter what. That says that is, that trumps, that is more important than the woman's life. So that's an important distinction that says only one of those can be honored. There's no conversation about what if this does something seriously harmful or detrimental to a life that's already here. Right?
I'm going to say, I think in modern times, everything is just so polarized. So, and our issues are so complex that it's really hard to be like, it's like winner take all, you know? So I can feel this way about this thing. And at the same time, this way about this thing. And also not know 15 other things aren't even on the table, but only one choice wins out overall. And that is very frustrating to me personally. I'm sure others struggle. Well, but that's kind of what I think.
So when we come to decisions that are made out of ethics, sometimes there has to be a decision. Is it legal or illegal? Is it protected by the Constitution or is it not? We have to make decisions to live together. So it's not that there can't be two sides and one side wins and one side loses. That there we have to have winners and losers when you're arguing, yes, it should be done. No, it shouldn't be done. But to your point, Jewish tradition has always said, what is the point of our arguing about this? Is it for me to be right? Or is it for us to reach a decision l'shem shamayim, that we are doing this for the sake of heaven? We're doing this for the sake of trying to actually get to what we think is the best decision. And in the Jewish case, there's winners and losers. The winners were the majority. The decision always went according to the majority. However, the decision and the reasoning of the minority was always included on the page. When rendering the decision and how we got there, the arguments against it and the rationale are all presented. So that, okay, this Thursday we've decided this is going to, it's going to be legal. We're going to do this. And then circumstances change and we decide maybe not now. Right now AI comes to mind. You know, like what might be okay right now about AI may not be so okay 6 years from now, right? And so we want to revisit and not lose the wisdom and the thinking of the side that had to lose that day. But 6 years from now, we might use their arguments to say, we got this, is because this can't be legal anymore. It's getting too dangerous for all of these new reasons. And their thinking was absolutely right, given the new reality.
Yeah.
So it's not that we can't have arguments. It's not that we shouldn't argue. We should. And there part of it is what is the actual purpose of the argument? To really reach a good compromise, a good decision is something we can all live with, you know, or for power, for control, for, you know, fundamentalist kind of, you know, extreme, you know, whatever positions. And I think that's about power. I think that's about a lot of things and control. Yes, Katrina, go ahead.
Doesn't the idea of relationships take us back as well to creationist ethics that and human dignity, that if we're going to consider the effect of our actions on others, requires recognizing the dignity in others and caring about what the impact of our actions will be on other people, which in our increasingly polarized society is very difficult to do, because I think that our sides tend to care about the effect on those that are within that same side and group.
Right. Lovely. So I love that statement about we can disagree with each other. It's when we stop appreciating the inherent dignity of the other who has a different position from mine, we are already violating creation ethics. Right? We're already going against one of the main pillars of our understanding of how we're supposed to behave in the world, is that we can argue. That's fine. That's the Jewish sport, right? I always joke that's the only sport we're born good at as a people. So we should argue l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven. And then the Talmud tells us Hillel and Shammai argued all the time. Beit Hillel, the school of Hillel, the school of Shammai, they argued all the time. And then they went and married each other's daughters. Right? You know, that the idea was they did not leave the argument any less committed to each other. They actually married into each other's families. Can you imagine today, like a heated debate between a Republican and a Democrat, and then they're excited to go see their kids who are married to each other and go sit at the family table and have dinner with the grandkids? And that is a serious value that I love that you pointed out, that we have stopped seeing the dignity of the other. But the difference we're going to talk about is now is the shift from when universal ethics, creation ethics, are in tension with covenant ethics. When what you might say broadly we should or should not do comes into tension when there's a choice to be made between doing what I need to do for the people close to me and the people writ large. If I have $100, right, and everybody's suffering, where do I put it? Right? Should I give it all to some universal feeding hungry children in the world charity? Or should I look at also giving something locally, right, to the kids in LA who don't have it? Right. So it's more that kind of tension that we're now going to look at between creation ethics. All kids deserve to be fed. We can all agree on that. All children deserve to be fed. But are we going to put all of our resources into a universal approach to feeding children? Or are we going to say, I'm going to give some to that? And I also need to think about the kids here in LA. Right.
Is that what covenant? I'm trying to ask
God, yes.
Because when I hear the word covenant, I think of the Jewish covenant with God. And so are we talking about just among Jews or among
society? Let's look at source number two. Mm-hmm. All right. So we are ethically bound. We're going to look at source number two from the Babylonian Talmud, Baba Metzia. And this section of the Talmud attempts to answer questions about how to prioritize limited funds that are going to be used for interest-free loans. According to the Bible, you can't charge interest to another Israelite. By the way, this is how we get to Jews lending money in medieval Europe, because the church saw itself as the new Israel. And so if Israel can't lend to other Israelites at interest, then we can't do that either as the new Israel, as Christians, right? And so, but that meant no businesses would start, right? And this noble couldn't wage war against that noble, right? So who could lend money to those people at interest? The Jews. So that's where a lot of that gets started. So interest-free loans. And by the time of the Talmud, these are understood as grants. Like you're going to give money to somebody to do something, but there's limited resources. So let's look at Baba Metzia. And they're going to bring, of course, the Talmud's, you know, a lot of these things are always going to bring as a proof text. We've talked about this. You bring as a proof text something from Torah, right? Okay. If you lend my people money, even the poor with you, and that's from Exodus 22:24, my people or strangers, my people have precedence. A poor person or a rich one, the poor have precedence. Your poor relatives and the poor of your city, your poor relatives have precedence. The poor of your city and the poor of another city, the poor of your city have precedence. So this is the ruling of the Talmud, that when you come down to limited funds, and all these people are coming to ask you for grants, right? They're all coming to ask you for loans because their business is failing, their crops failed 2 years in a row, and they need to buy seed, right, or whatever. And you have limited funds, but there's way more people coming than you have funds for. How do you decide who gets precedence? And so if you, to your point, Bert, that Talmud would say, if it's between Jews and non-Jews, Jews get precedence, right? If you choose between a poor person and a wealthy person, if that's your choice, you choose the poor person gets precedence. Now, if there's no one else coming and only a wealthy person's coming, fine, right? But it's assuming that's not going to be the case. It's assuming when you've got free money, right? Lots of people are going to be coming to get it. And so on down the line, between a poor relative and a poor neighbor, we choose the poor relative. Choosing between a poor neighbor and a poor person who lives in a different town, we choose the poor neighbor. And in Jewish ethical thought, there's an assumption that the greater the depth of the relationship, the greater the ethical obligation. Right?
Is the expectation you get money back? I'm just curious.
Yes. But understanding, of course, that you may not.
Okay, so is it charity or a loan?
It's supposed to be a loan, but you're not going to make money on it. You're not going to make any money on it. So it's sort of a charitable loan.
I hate to be practical, but what about if the person's going to give it back to you? I mean, shouldn't that factor into your...
It doesn't. It doesn't. No. You'd think a wealthy person would be more likely to give it to you than a poor person. That does not factor in. It's who are you obligated to lend the money to, right? So the greater the depth, the greater the Jewish obligation. And this is what Hartman calls covenant ethics. We live in covenant. We live in relationship. Barbara. I can't hear you.
Another nuance.
Okay.
To imply to where there's the greatest need, a poor person has greater need than a wealthy person. But in at least modern thought, philanthropy, there's usually a tension between did I give to the greatest need or where it would do the greatest good.
Right.
I don't know.
So that is not here. That is not here. Is the greatest need or where it will do the greatest good? That is not here. I'm not saying they didn't have those conversations, but what they seem to be concerned about is if someone from your city needs it and they have exactly the same portfolio as somebody in Santa Monica, you give it to someone from here. And if it's someone from outside your family or someone from inside your family, you give it to the person inside your family. Jeff?
Well, this is wonderful, and thank you. I'm a little confused, which I get occasionally, in that when I hear this, it's lovely. I mean, it's just really a lovely intention. But we live in an age of the corporate mentality.
Okay, so we're not going to go there.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not going there. I want to stay with this.
I'm not going there.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, as you know, I was in the criminal justice system for, not in jail. I worked for defense attorneys and I loved, and it made me feel so right. I'm not bragging. I'm just, when I could do a pro bono case for the ACLU or something like that, but then, we start building up enemies, and that's what I want to hear about. You know, the district attorney would look at me like, and I wasn't making any money. How do we survive?
I want to stay with the competition. You have resources. You're fine. You have money to give. It's limited. Who's coming to you? Are people competing for your money? You're fine. You have this money to give. The question is, do we have a greater moral obligation to people with whom we're in relationship? And I just had this conversation today with somebody talking about his brother and something's just gone down with the family estate. You know, the parent just died and now they find out the estate has been, you know. And so we were talking about, like, when it comes to family, money is complicated and we have a lot of feelings about money. And it's that sense of, and he said, you know, my brother's not even somebody I would talk to as a friend. Like, this is not somebody I would be friends with. And yet, you know, we're talking about money and divvying up money and sharing money and who owes, you know, and how much people should get. And then we were talking about giving to siblings who are not people you would be friends with. Why is that? You know, like I support my sister often when she needs money. And she's not somebody I would be friends with, right? But what's the answer? Because she's my sister. I have an obligation to, if I have the resources to help her, right? I have the obligation to help my nephew. And it's not about how close are we, right? How much do I feel connected to the, right? That's not, this is very much covenant ethics, that that's your sister, that's your nephew, whatever. And so your obligation is to help where you can. Mary?
So I think the implication of this is that everyone who's capable starts with their inner circle, their own, the whole charity begins at home kind of thing. So you ripple out from that, basically. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that everyone who can does that for their circle, and hopefully it ripples outward.
Because if everyone did that and took it seriously, what would happen? Everyone would get taken care of, right? And that ultimately is the bottom line for the Jewish ethical understanding of obligation vis-a-vis relationship. Everybody's in relationship to somebody. Even if you just live in a town, you could be somebody who has no family, but you live in a town. So you're right. If you have that $100 that you're supposed to give it to somebody from, you know, Brentwood or someone from here, it's the most ridiculous examples to use, right? Should you give it to the Palisadian or the Brentwood resident? But that's the understanding. So everybody is part of community. Everybody is part of some kind of relationship network. And if everybody gave to their networks, you know, and that those get bigger and bigger and bigger, my country, then another country, then what, then the idea is that everyone ultimately is taken care of. Marissa.
Is ethics obligation, because I'm getting a little confused and it is the first time I'm studying anything like this, but it feels like this is putting ethics equals rules, where to me it feels like ethics is more of a very subjective thing, maybe based on intuition or relationships. Again, it's subjective, and it feels like this is putting rules on something that feels more personal. I'm just a little,
right.
Maybe it's a little
so, close. Well, because we're studying Jewish halachic texts. These are legal texts. This is telling you Jewish law says, yes, that's what you are supposed to do. Yes, this is a legal conversation.
Okay.
Yes. And I understand what you're saying is you're not used to thinking of law that way, that these are usually personal decisions. Well, Jewish law doesn't have that understanding that you have decisions that you make that are not referenced
right.
by the tradition.
Okay. And different religions, different people, different families have different ethics because presumably their texts or their circumstances, everything is different.
Correct.
So it's a constant like ethics v ethics conversation.
Yes. And many of us would call this, because we're not halachic, we would call this guidance from the tradition, right? When you're thinking about giving or lending, right. whatever you're doing, that these are the guiding principles, because we don't actually apply this to ourselves as Jewish law, but they start as legal texts about, yes, what should you do? Helpful. Yes. And it's helpful as a guiding, whether we agree to do it or not, whether we agree, ultimately say, yes, that's what I'm going to do or not. We find it helpful as a people to have this set of references that we go back to, right? To begin the conversation, to begin figuring out what our relationship to it is. Bert?
As non-halachic Jews,
yeah,
which I think most of us are, it nevertheless, as you say, is wonderful to have this over 1,000-year conversation where people a lot smarter than us have delved into these questions. So for me, it's exactly that. And that is, there are people who really had these discussions, and you read the discussions and say, oh, I didn't think of that. Well, maybe this, it's a lot more complicated than what I thought. One thing that's not here, and maybe this is a completely separate thing, is my first responsibility is to
me,
myself.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other conversation, sometimes within a family. What am I prepared to give to another family member? It could be money. This is about money.
Mm-hmm.
It could also be about other things, sure, emotions and whatever. What, how much of a, am I prepared to sacrifice? And does that really, but so these are complicated things.
Well, but that's also there in the law. The law says you're not allowed to give to a place where now you're dependent on tzedakah from the community. You're not allowed to martyr yourself and give all your money away, and now the community has to support you. You're not allowed to do that. Now you're putting pressure on the community that wasn't there if you'd have taken care of yourself.
You can't martyr yourself?
You cannot martyr
yourself. Jewish mothers know that?
That is a, they don't study Talmud.
Oh, okay.
So the, right. So, but the assumption in any case like the one we just looked at, the assumption is you are already taken care of. Now you can have a conversation about what is taken care of, right? If I'm eating, you know, beans and rice every night, is that really, am I really taking care of myself and taking responsibility for my own health, right? Because I want to give it to my children. But that's a different conversation. But the assumption here is you're taken care of. You're fine. Because that's your first obligation, is to feed yourself, right? And to make sure you have what you need. Mm-hmm.
It just seems like if we follow this, nobody would ever give to the sanctuary revival. I mean, because every family has some people in need, or who need more than that, then they would not be giving to some charity.
This doesn't say give every extra penny you have away to loans, right? It's saying if a theater in Santa Monica needs remodeling and it's a really important thing culturally and whatever that we want, or a library and we want to see it redone, should we do that first or the sanctuary first? Yeah, exactly. That's the president of the synagogue, right? And the leader of the campaign, the co-chair of the campaign, right? So that's more the question. Like if a library needs, you know, redoing, or a civic center that we really are proud of, you know, on the west side needs to be redone and the sanctuary is falling apart, which do you give your money to first? You give it to the sanctuary project first because it's your community's, right, gathering place. Lori?
And I just think that, you know, obviously this is meant to then sort of set general guidelines. Like this, right, one quote isn't going to answer every single,
correct,
question.
Correct.
But it just says your obligation to people that you're in relationship with, or your obligations depend on the nature of your relationship. Okay. Now, it's just, going forward. So every case then is going to say, well, we're going to look to that law and we'll see how can we fit that concept into what's going on here. Because it may be that the person that you're in relationship has less need than the person who's, mm-hmm, farther out. So then you have to figure out, but you at least have this foundational, right, concept that everybody's going to accept, which is that relationship impacts value decisions.
Yes, which is in tension with creation ethics.
Everybody is.
Which is everybody equally deserving of assistance, right? And so Judaism doesn't shy away from the fact that they're in tension. Judaism doesn't try to harmonize it and say, oh, it's fine. This is how you figure that, right? It's that they live in constant tension with each other. And we're living in such a moment. Right? And our ethical discussion doesn't shy away from that. It acknowledges both are there, both are present, both are important, both are always going to be there, and they're always going to be in tension. And for us to have language about that, I think is always super helpful.
And as opposed to the absolutist view of ethics, which is we hold these things to be self-evident. Like this kind of a text says there's nothing that's self-evident. And you have to chew on it and fight with each question.
And we need to be told. We need to be taught what is.
But Dr. Rick, just I'm reading with the first line she quoting Martin Luther King, and the terms are, as humans, we are interdependent. And he says, an inescapable network of mutuality. Just if you could give me your take on those two things, interdependence and inescapable network.
I mean, I think that's just human life. That's how we live.
Okay. That's.
that we are all interdependent. We're in, you know, we have relationships and we depend on one another, and it goes back and forth and it moves in different dynamics, and that is in tension with, right, this idea of creation ethics.
Sorry. I do remember that term, codependent, as well.
Yeah, that's a little different. All right, let's look at source number three.
Yeah, thank you.
Source number three is from Devarim, is from Deuteronomy, which is very concerned with law, and it is concerned with changing some of the law that comes earlier. So this is a school of thought. It is a religious reformation in ancient Israel that comes to overturn a lot of what happened before. And so we're going to look at what Devarim focuses on. So that covenant obligations that we just described and talked about, it's not just refraining from harm in terms of our ethical obligations, which we saw a lot in the creation ethics text that we looked at, but there are other positive obligations. We just saw some, like who the positive obligation is to vis-a-vis other people, but that we have to build a system in our societies and in community to provide like lots of things for folks, not just money, not just right material things. All right. So let's go to source three. Let's go to Deuteronomy 7. If there should be among you, right? Already that's hilarious. Should there be among you a poor person, right? One of your kin within any of your dwelling places in your land, which God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your needy kin. Right here, meaning another Israelite.
I think it's interesting. It says, and by the way, in the land that God gave you.
Yeah, right, right.
That you didn't get yourself.
That you didn't acquire, right? Because
kin means Israelite, not.
Kin means Israelite.
Not your family.
Correct. You shall sure.
I have a problem with this.
Good. Okay.
I mean, you know, suppose I had a brother who was impoverished because he was a heroin addict and, you know, spending all his money on heroin. But I have an obligation to basically meet his needs when he is, you know, not using whatever resources he has wisely.
So it doesn't say to what extent. What it might mean is you decide, I'm not going to let him starve. I'm going to make sure there's groceries in his house every week. What he does with them is not my business. But there is a floor beneath which, right? And it might mean I send him to, you know, treatment. It might mean, you know, I make sure there's some kind of roof over his, you know, but like this is not going to get into the details of what that means. That is adjudicated way further down the line in the Talmud, right? Mishnah, Talmud, all these other texts. But one of the principles that are given about entering the land is your general attitude should be, do not harden your heart and shut your hand from people who are needy. Your orientation should be not to do that. Are there exceptions? Of course. Are there some ways if I give to him, then I'm just going to enable him and he's going to get worse? Of course. In general, your attitude should be you are ready to help needy folk in your country, in this land that you're now going to inherit. That, by the way, is the size of the state of Vermont, right? This is not a huge, this is not Russia, right? You know, this is a tiny little place. You shall surely open your hand to them and lend them sufficient for their need, right? So he doesn't even say give them. Necessarily, right? Lend them. And remember, we're talking about an agrarian society. So in general, we're talking about people whose crops fail, right? And you're supposed to be willing and ready to lend money so that other people have the opportunity to get themselves out of debt before they become so impoverished that now they're going to have to sell themselves into indentured servitude. Because that's what happens, by the way. If you get poor enough, you sell yourself into indentured servitude and or your children. That's just normative. That's what happens. We know that. Mm-hmm. All right. So you're supposed to try to prevent that.
This is not a big city. These are smaller communities.
Correct.
Where ostensibly people know each other.
Correct.
and the families are interconnected.
Correct. Beware lest there be a base thought in your heart saying, the seventh year, the year of remission, is at hand, and you be evil to your needy kin and give them nothing, that they cry out to the Lord against you and guilt comes upon you. This is about the year of release. This is about property going back to the original owners. I don't want to get off on that. That's a whole nother thing. You shall surely give them, and you shall not be discontented in your giving to them. Because for this thing, Adonai, your God, will bless you in all of your actions and all of your undertakings. If you are generous, you will be dealt with by the provider of all generously. Right? This is a theocracy. We don't have to argue with that. That it just is what it was. It was a theocracy. So if you follow the law of God, who is king of the land, well, of everything, right? Then the king will be generous with you. Right? That's just
like
that.
Karma?
Not karma. This karma is direct cause and effect. This is karma is like, well, we'll see and around the bend. And this is, if you give generously, your crops will do well. Right? And again, we're not going to argue the theology. That's not the point. The point is, this was their theology. This was their understanding of things. What we're looking at is the basis of what Israelite ethical behavior was thought to look like and be based in. Because we just started with, if there should ever be a needy person among you, what does verse 11 say? For there shall always be poor in the land, right? Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall surely open your hand to the poor and needy in your land. All right. So, we have an understanding of this in this country, right? Or we say we do. Right? That every child should be educated in this country, right? We understand that it doesn't matter how poor a kid is, they should have an education. And we as a society tax ourselves to make sure that that happens. We get this. There should be lunch, school lunch at every school. There should be free transportation to that school in case kids can't get there. We understand this. There should be medical care of some kind for all Americans. Well, most of us understand that. That there, no matter how poor someone is, we should not begrudge. We don't give it directly, but we pay our taxes so that this happens. We understand this. We live like this. Now, we don't go to direct cause and effect as a theocracy because we're not a theocracy. Well, most of us do not see America as a theocracy.
This whole system is one about community and connection. It's not about what are my rights. Sure. It's not that I can do whatever I want and forget about everybody else. It's the opposite of part of what the American spirit is about. This is part of the tension in our country right now between this, I don't want to get into politics, but it's been that way for a very long time. The frontier spirit, I can do whatever I want. It's all about my rights, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. And what do we do about the poor?
But arguing from a different perspective, I think Torah would say the poor have rights. It is about rights. The poor have rights. And you can't violate them by refusing to give some of what you have that's extra to supporting them. They have rights.
Right? Not according to 49.8.
but that's not our problem. Right. But my curriculum says, you know, what works about this system? What are the challenges? Right. And you've just lifted up the challenges. As you know, when people say, why should I have to give for people who are sitting around doing nothing?
Why is it my response?
Why is it my responsibility? And by the way, this is why the kibbutz movement failed in Israel. When we were there in Israel, we had a wonderful lecture at a kibbutz by one of the founding members. And they said, this is the reason it failed. Because when everybody on the kibbutz had nothing, everybody had the same percentage of nothing. We're all going to have equal houses and equal sizes and equal whatever. And we eat the same food. And when everybody had nothing, that was fine. When the kibbutz did well and they had a lot, and now you had more money coming into the kibbutz, then Shmulik, who lays around on the front lawn, sunning himself and smoking cigars all day, is going to get the same cut as I, who was president
of the board who runs everything, who works 24/7. Like, what are you talking about? Absolutely not. And that's where it broke down, right? So that's when everybody has nothing or very little, right? You go to countries where they have nothing and you see how easily they share with one another, how easily they'll invite someone to come eat of the tiny little bit that they have, right? Or to sleep in their leaky, you know, metal thrown together cardboard hut. You're welcome here in my home, right? It's we who have a lot and are attached to how much we have, right? Our materialism, our consumerism, or whatever, that get very stingy about why should I worry about, you know, that lazy guy over there, his kids. Let him worry about his kids. Let him get a job, right? So those are the inherent challenges. Are, you know, we want to hold on to our comfort, our extra, our ability to buy ourselves goods and services, right? So beyond practical support, all this has been about money. Let's look at Leviticus. Now it's going to get a little hard. Text number 4. Lo tisna et achicha bilvovecha, hocheach tochiach et amitecha, velo tisa alavchet. You shall not hate your fellow in your heart. Achicha, your brother, meaning the person who lives next door to you, right? Mm-hmm. It's not your brother, right? It's everyone's in the society is supposed to be your brother, your sister. So you shall not hate them in your heart. Rather, hocheach tochiach. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor. Now, this is the conjunctive or the disjunctive of. Is it and or but? And, right? Don't sin on because of it or because of them. Or is it, but don't sin on because of them. All right. So you shall not hate your neighbor in your heart. Rather, you should rebuke them.
If they do wrong.
Well, so that's the question. Torah doesn't say. But clearly, it seems if you're going to rebuke them, Torah seems to be implying they've done something wrong.
Can you define rebuke for me?
To call them out.
Okay.
Call them out.
No revenge.
But not in a way that now it's on you. Now you've done something bad. Okay. So,
that in public.
So the rabbis say that means you don't do it in public. You don't embarrass someone. You take them aside. Right? And which is why I gave you this, because I just was unsatisfied with leaving, you know me. If you've learned Torah with me, you know I'm not going to be satisfied leaving it there. So I gave you, right, commentary that goes to where the rabbis understand. If you look at the Or HaChaim on Leviticus 19, the Torah urges that if we harbor some resentment against a fellow Jew, do not bottle it up in one's heart, saying nothing and hating the Jew in question. One has to come out with one's feelings into the open, beficha, with your mouth, and rebuke the person who one thinks as guilty of having bad-mouthed him or otherwise hurt him to have caused such hatred, right? So that you will not bear a sin on account of him. Do not assume in your heart that whatever it is the other Jew has done to cause you to hate him, he's done purposely, and that he, so that you continue, or, and that he continues to feel hostile towards you. Give him the benefit of the doubt and discuss the matter with him. Mm-hmm. The discussion could lead to one of two possible results, says the Or HaChaim. One, he may explain to you that he had a good reason for what he did, so that there's no reason to hate him. Or two, he may change his attitude towards you, undertaking not to continue the hostile conduct. As a result, he becomes your friend, truly achicha, your brother. Mm. Right? So for the rabbis, they want to take this one step further, right? That someone's dissed you. That's why else would you hate them in your heart?
Right.
They dissed you. And so your obligation is to go confront it so that you're not carrying that around and hating him all or her all the time. If you have to go confront them about it, but in such a way that now you're not in the wrong, then a couple of things might happen. The person might go, that is not what I intended. That is not what I said. That was taken completely out of context. Here's what happened. Here's what I said. And you're like, oh, all this time I've been seething for nothing, right? Or they may say, I had no idea
it was that hurtful, right? Or I had no idea she was going to repeat it. I'm really sorry, right? I understand now that I've really hurt you, right? And then now you can repair it and make up, right? So the rabbis are taking that biblical verse and saying, isn't that really how we should behave in general? Right? Not walking around hating people in our hearts.
So we're turning conflict into a conference, into a...
So we're taking conflict into communication.
Yeah, thank you.
Lo tikom velo titor et b'nei amecha ve'ahavta le'echa kamocha ani Adonai. Burt Kleinman's favorite verse in the Torah. You shall not take vengeance nor bear a grudge against your fellow citizens. Rather, ve'ahavta le'echa kamocha. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am God. Yes.
So I just question on the last piece. Could you say... You mentioned use your mouth at some point.
The rabbi said that.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to make sure. That's kind of interesting because you have to actually talk to
them. Yes.
But right. You can't just go get someone to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, write mm-hmm. an article and you know, you have to actually speak. Mm-hmm.
That is what the Orach Chaim is saying. That yes, rebuke means you have to do it b'ficha, with your mouth.
Okay, that's actually... really interesting.
It's really interesting. Yeah. And I think really insightful, right? I think it's really...
Can't get on social media.
And start trashing them,
yes.
You know, and calling them out.
And do a private message.
Right?
I think you have to actually... You can't speak to someone unless... Well, I guess with the telephone. But here, you'd have to actually be face-to-face mm-hmm. with them, which is extremely interesting about conflict. Resolution.
It 100% is, and is very much a Jewish philosophy about conflict, right? Management.
And why is there no third possibility here, going back to this last one, of the person's just an ass and they're gonna think you're crazy for confronting them and you're still not gonna like them?
Because you have to try. You have to make the effort. Then if they're still an ass, they're an ass. That's not on you. But you're still not supposed to be caught up in hating them.
Mm.
It's like, okay, well, they are obviously, I've done my part. Like, I'm very clear. I'm not going to be dealing with that person anymore. Right? I'm done.
Right.
And you're not walking around seething and like wishing terrible things on them.
Yeah. I read this, the first one, the verse 17 differently, which
a lot of people need to
base, but, I thought it spoke to our communal responsibility, which is also underlying the sense of relationship, is that like if somebody does something wrong, it's your responsibility to correct them for the sake of the community, but should not hate that person for what they've done. You are rebuking them for the sake of the community and therefore you're not going to make things worse, I feel like
it's so there. So
I don't
there,
know if that's in it, there at
yeah,
all.
Yes, it is. It's implied that the idea is to create a sanctified community. And to do that, if somebody's acting like an ass, the rabbis are the one who said they did something to you. You may hate somebody because you see them being terrible to other people. You could read that into the biblical verse. Right. They're doing something out there, and like, it's your job to be an upstander and say, look, like, pull them aside and say, yo, like, not okay.
And if you don't, then you're going to share in the sin. You shall rebuke them and then you won't bear the sin.
So that is the part open into interpretation. Volo, but you shouldn't. Lo means not you won't. You shouldn't. Don't. Sin. That's how it usually gets translated, but you don't get to like go off on them in public, right? And tear into them. You don't,
because then you're the,
now you, right. Now you've done something wrong by shaming somebody.
No, in excess.
Correct. So that seems to be how it's usually interpreted, but I think, right, if you're careful about how you do it, then you won't sit on their behalf, right? I mean, or as a result of it.
Or
aid and abet terrible, right, behavior, right? Which, by the way, we're terrible at doing. We're terrible at talking to each other really about what makes us crazy about the other person. But, you know, back to the point about the dignity of the other. We don't even give people, we don't even understand the dignity of the other person as demanding that I talk to them. I just go ahead and hate them.
I think that's a reaction to, I think about community dynamics. Like, I've spent a lot of my mental energy on this. I live in a very interesting community. I'm a part of a number of different, not just hobby groups, but at work. Like, I'm all about seeing groups of people. And I think that we don't think about community relationships, and we think about our personal relationships a lot, or our family relationships, because we're managing that immediacy around us. I really like this a lot, and I don't think I always get the chance to, like, think about, like, some boring corporate training, like, oh, do this, do that for me. No, just, like, be cool. Talk to the person next to you. Mm-hmm. Have a conversation with them. If you think they have a problem with you, like, just go get some lunch and just be like, why are you, what's wrong? Do you want to talk about this? So I find a lot of value in this. I just wanted to, you know, state that on the phone that, you know, for people like me who deal in communities a lot, like, this is very, I'm glad to have this. So,
And it's important that we revisit it, right? Particularly now, right? Particularly now. The reason I started Foundations for, that's what it's called, right? Yeah. Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism. If you'll recall, the reason we're doing this is because I gave a sermon on Rosh Hashanah years ago talking about polarization and how polarized we are. So let's not talk right and left. Let's not talk right and wrong. Let's not talk red and blue. Let's not talk Democrat, Republican, you know, conservative, liberal. Let's talk Judaism. Let's talk Jewish values. Let's start there. Let's educate ourselves there. And let's at least build that in our community that we're going to engage with a discussion about how we're supposed to engage with each other and ethics and values based in Jewish texts. Hopefully that at least will bring us together differently, and that makes us go out there differently. The next conversation we have might be a little different after having this conversation, right? And that's what we can do. Like, we can't fix it all. Can't even address the big issues, but we can address us, right? And marinating in our own teachings and texts. All right. So these are emotional and social requirements. Look at source 5. Now it gets harder. Right? Exodus 23, verse 4. If you encounter, who are we dealing with now? Your enemy. If you encounter your enemy's ox or donkey wandering, you shall surely bring it back to your enemy. And similarly, verse 5, if you see the donkey of the person who hates you lying under its burden, so an anti-Semite in our context, right, their donkey is lying under its burden, you shall not leave without helping them. You shall surely release it with them, meaning you shall help get that load off the donkey so the donkey can stand back up, right? So now Torah's pushing to a much harder place for us, which is it's when it's achicha, your, you know, brother, your sister, whatever, it meaning, you know, a citizen, you know, if it's re'echa, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So now it's just one of your, somebody in your community. Now we're at, okay, well, what if it's your enemy? What if it's someone who you know hates you? And it's even working actively, right, to get you fired, you know, or whatever, God forbid, undermining your business, you know, like doing stuff actively as someone who's demonstrated they can't stand you, they hate you. Then what? What are my obligations vis-a-vis that person and why? So notice it's not just the enemy who's involved. It's also the enemy's ox or donkey. So just because that person hates you doesn't exonerate you from helping the poor donkey, right? Like,
they didn't do anything.
They didn't do anything. You know, so you think about people who hate each other and they treat the other one's kids terribly. It's just like, wait, what? Like, right, this family situation, and he's like, you know, but I don't know whether to tell the kids about what's happened with, you know, my brother. And I'm like, you know, why take your kids' cousins away from them? Like, what, you know, they didn't do anything. You know, so it's like, because that's this, the cousins didn't do anything, right? Just because the brother's being a jerk, right? Like it. I think that's very much, you know, the spirit here.
I also think it's interesting that it, I mean, unless it says it later, but it doesn't say anything then about making sure your enemy knows that you were the one that did it.
That's like right.
Asking for anything in return.
That's exactly right.
Put your nose in their face, or even to say, hey, anti-Semite, you hated me, but I helped your donkey. And so maybe that'll help you think differently.
That's exactly right. That's right. You don't get to say, therefore, because I was good, I expect you to change. You know, I expect something now to be different. It's not the point. The point is you.
Yeah.
Torah cares about you, not the person. Don't you become somebody who would go to the cousins and say, do you know what your father did? Don't you become that person, right? Because you can't control what somebody else is going to do, right? Whether they're going to care about it or change or not change. What Torah cares about is don't you become the person who's going to walk by. Right. And in another sermon I gave, I don't even know when, recently, at High Holidays, there was a study done by people who they set up people who were becoming, I want to say like psychologists, you know, they were going to be therapists or someone helping profession like that, medical or something like that. They're in school to be that. They're students, and they set them up for a lab experiment, where they told them that they were late for their interview with the questioner. Like, you're late for your appointment. And so now they have to hurry. And you're late by 5 minutes or by 10 minutes or by 15 minutes. And then other people weren't told they were late. So then they took the students and they sat them down and they had them walk by an actor who was acting like something was wrong and like in a doorway and slumping to the, you know, like something was wrong, but it wasn't like somebody who's on drugs and heroin. Like, it was clearly somebody who looked like just a regular person who was in trouble. And they gave a questionnaire to the students on the other side and they watched their behavior. The ones who, the later they thought they were, the lower the score on whether or not they even noticed, right? Much less did they stop to check out what was going on. The ones who were told they weren't late had a very high score for checking out what was going on, right? So why did I go into that? Because what it says is, if you're not careful, you can think you're very compassionate and you're a very compassionate person. But if you keep doing walking by the guy you hate's donkey, under a burden, and then you walk by the person, you know, who you find something that belongs to the guy who, you know, hates you and don't return it, and you just walk by, right? That cultivates then this you actually change, right? These students were the same compassionate human beings, but because they were in a hurry and they were rushed, it lowered their capacity for compassion. And Torah seems to be saying it also happens through habit. If we habitually make excuses for why we don't have to care or get involved minimally, it's not saying you have to feed it and take it to a great, you know, barn and get it washed and like get the vet to check it out. Like, it minimally to return it. You know where it lives, presumably. If we stop doing the bare minimum, because we can justify it because we know they hate us, then that becomes a problem for us, because it becomes who we are, I think, is what Torah, right, law is trying to guard against. So, and maybe what could come out of it, like with Hocheach Tochiach, rebuking someone, is that maybe we build a bridge that wasn't there before. Okay, they don't care about you. What if you do the minimum and not turn away from it when you can do it pretty easily, right? The minimum that will happen is everybody's a little happier. They're like, the people who get their things back are a little happier, you know, but that's minimally. But maximally, you build a society where everyone's building their compassion muscles and their muscles of standing up and taking responsibility in moments where it's not easy, right? And this is, you know, metta practice. When you meditate and you start with someone you love and wishing them well and blessing them and seeing them, you know, healthy and whole and getting all that they want in life. And then you go to someone who you're not so close to, right? This is metta practice. And then you go to a stranger, and then you go to someone who really pisses you off. Right. And that's the practice is, how do we build capacity for that? Because it's not about them. Right. It's about who we are and who we become. And it is we who will build a society, if we're paying attention and wanting to try and taking this seriously, then the society that these folks will build will be, right, the one that Jewish values wants to see become a reality. Right.
I really like was the term is metaphor. And the metaphor I really like that you said was bridge, building a bridge. I mean, two people on either side can just look and decide to make that move across and meet each other, whether it's one third or two thirds, you know, if you meet. But yeah, metaphor.
And so then we have, so then of course, where this is so excruciating to actually figure out is exactly the situation we're in right now. Right? Where what do you do vis-a-vis the enemy? And to what extent? And who decides? Right? And it is a very painful conversation happening both in Israel and here. Here, you know, about anti-Semitism and all that we see, you know, in our society, and how we feel about what's happening in Israel and has happened. And in Israel, it's a very painful conversation about what are our moral obligations when we're dealing with the enemy. And it is an absolutely excruciating conversation. It is, and there are no good answers right now, right? I'm not suggesting, oh, well, just study the text. Well, you know, the answers, the text, in fact, raises and surfaces our absolute clash of values that are expressed here. The absolute clash of how do you do that when you also have to keep your people safe and when you, right, have to make sure that you're defending your people. And so Kurtzer lays, we're not going to go into it now, but just to let you know, so Kurtzer sets up kind of what are the four categories of moral and ethical areas of concern. And it's not as obvious as us and them, you know, the enemy and like it's not that. It's much more subtle. He believes we have to be having much more sophisticated conversations about this stuff and breaking it down in much more deeply reflective ways to really reflect on this moment. And so he breaks it into four categories so you can look at it and decide if you agree. Like, are these some of the right moral categories for us to start? What does sovereignty mean when sovereignty means we control our borders and everything that happens within it? Like, what is that one of the ethical areas that really we should be talking about vis-a-vis the situation in Israel right now?